Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
All right, I think it's time to start back up. So, in our three-point model, we've done encourage, and we've done some in comfort, and then the last parental function is to urge. I've always thought that Greek word like the word mature, and it's basically to charge, to motivate, or to train. So we're going to, Paul said, when I was with you, I treated you like a father would treat you. My behavior was consistent. Then we encouraged, we comforted, and we urged you. And I use the word urge in this passage to think about the idea of discipline. My definition for discipline is to put stress in a relationship so that the result is growth. All punishment is not discipline. All discipline is not punishment. The definition I use is we put stress in the relationship so that the relationship is growth, and it fulfills the third perception. First perception, I'm capable. Second perception is I'm significant. And the third perception is I can influence what happens to me. This is where you have that unique balance between permissiveness and strictness on the love side. We're talking about the bedtime routine. You change your strategy there to move from permissive down toward that middle ground and move from strict up toward that middle ground so that the bedtime routine becomes, you know what? Your bedtime is 8:30. I'm going to set a timer. Everything after 8:30 with me standing in here dealing with monsters and putting out fires and bringing water, that's going to come off playground time or iPad time or cartoon time. You're a big boy. You get to choose how you want to use the next few minutes of your life. And then he gets a voice. Dad stays longer. Dad stays less. But when dad does, I pay it back. And that's where you give them permission. I let you make some choices, but I'm also not going to be manipulated. And so I can influence what happens to me. And like I say, most of the time when you do one of these seminars, people enjoy the encourage and people enjoy the comfort. But the bottom line is, okay, let's get to discipline. Well, let's read maybe some fun passages and then we'll talk a little bit about some theoretical discipline stuff. Genesis chapter 16, I've always enjoyed this passage. Talking to Hagar, Genesis 16:11, and the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child. You shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, verse 12, and he shall be a wild donkey of a man. And his hand shall be against every one, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will dwell in the presence of his brethren with enmity. Yes, ADD in the Bible. There he is. You've all had that kid at VBS. He's a wild donkey of a man. Well, some of you are paying for your raising is all I can say. There's a sense of karmatic justice in the universe. If I'm standing at the back of a church building greeting people and a young man walks in, he's got three stair-step daughters, I say, God's paying you back for the way you dated, player. Anyway, so you just know that if you have daughters, God says, I was tired of the way you dated as a teenager, and he's paying you back. So just a little honesty there. And sometimes our kids are reflections of us. The other passage that I wanted to read is in 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5. And Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself and said, I will be king. He prepared for himself chariots and horsemen, 50 men to run before him. His father had never rebuked him. Some versions say his father had never questioned him. Some versions say his father had never interfered with him and said, "My son, why have you done so?" He was very good looking. He was born of his mother after Absalom. So sometimes we run into this discipline question when kids declare, "Hey, I'm king. I'm in charge. I run this place." And a lot of times kids declare, "I'm in charge, I'm king, and I run this place," because we've never questioned, rebuked, or interfered with them and made them call into account their actions. As I said earlier, my definition for discipline is to put stress in a relationship so the result is growth. And learning to do that is with limit setting and with logical consequences. A couple of books I'd recommend for you, Inside the Bell Curve, normal kid stuff, Raising Boys by James Dobson, The Strong-Willed Child by James Dobson, Dare to Discipline by James Dobson, Ending the Homework Hassle by John Roseman, Positive Classroom Discipline by Fred Jones. That's a really good work, especially if you work with kids or you're a teacher, but it also works in your house. Outside the Bell Curve is a book by Scott Sells, S-E-L-L-S, Scott Sells, Parenting the Out-of-Control Teenager. Now, it's interesting when you read a book like that. My theory is if it'll kill a hippopotamus, it'll kill a mouse. So sometimes you can use these high-powered weapons and just modulate them a little bit to deal with other stuff. And Sales has a really good approach to dealing with really extreme behavior with kids that kind of fall outside that bell curve of, hey, that's kid stuff and it's normal. He deals with truancy and violence and self-harm and promiscuity and all kind of stuff where kids are trying to manipulate their parents and gain control of their environment. But his principles work out pretty good. I think his website is difficult.net, which I thought was cool for a psychologist to have a difficult.net website. Basic theory, a couple of simple things. All human behavior is reward motivated. I do what I do the way I do it because it gets me something I want. Now, I've changed that over the years and said it either gets me something I want or gets me something I value. Mature people deal with values. Immature people deal with immediate wants. And, you know, as a mature person, I choose between what I want now and what I want most. And I can do that in math. Immature people only choose the immediate. I want to have fun. I want it to be cool. I don't want to do my homework. I don't want to clean my room. And so you kind of have to look at what's motivating the person. 9 times out of 10, when you're dealing with little kids and teenagers, they're doing what they do because it gets them some kind of immediate short-term reward. Okay? And who knows what reward it is. It may be to see you frustrated. It may just be to prove you're not in control. In Fred Jones's book, Positive Classroom Discipline, he says that anything other than compliance is backtalk. Period. Across the board. When I don't do what you've asked me to do, he translates that in some form or fashion as backtalk. From a strict behaviorist viewpoint, 4 seconds equals compliance. If you hadn't done it in 4 seconds, you did not comply. Even if you actually do it, delaying that says, I get to do this on my time. And so, when my behavior cost me more than it cost you, I'll reevaluate or change my behavior. So there's your formula. All behavior is reward motivated. I do what I do the way I do it because it gets me something I want or value. And when my behavior costs me more than it costs you, then I'll change my behavior. To put that in more simplistic terms, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And what's the third line? There's a third line. It's very small print. You can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink, but you can put salt in the oats. And if the oats have a lot of salt in them, do you fight about water? No, the horse is asking, can I have a drink of water, please? Okay, because you salt the oats, you don't have to argue with him about the water. And so pick your battlegrounds and find out the things that motivate them about their desire for water rather than your desire for them to desire water. And learning to use your resources and their lack of resources to kind of change that environment will make your life a little easier when it comes to discipline. Discipline is about consequences and choices. I can influence what happens to me. And so many times in discipline, we worry about making our kids happy. And really, it ought to be about your kids worrying about making you happy. You know, if you want to be miserable, you're welcome to be miserable. You'd be miserable in your room. I'm watching TV. I'm going to kill myself. Put plastic on the floor, you know. Try not to ruin the carpet. You know, I'm not going to run in here and intervene. I'm not going to chase you down when I'm being manipulated. If you think it's a legitimate, you know, threat, you respond to that. When my client's posture was suicide, they go to the hospital. 24-hour observation in-house. And the ones that are seriously suicidal don't mind going back. The ones that aren't don't want to go there again. But if you learn this is a get-out-of-jail-free card for everything, then you're controlling people with your behaviors. Discipline should have basically three categories. It should have immediacy, severity, and consistency. If you've got a rule, and I can break that rule, and the response to that rule doesn't have some kind of immediacy, and you know, it can be an immediate response, but not an immediate consequence. But if it doesn't have some level of immediacy, and it doesn't have some severity, and it's not consistent, then it's not really a rule. You ever taken advantage of a referee in a sport? Come to Jesus, some of you have. I played defensive end for a small club. And my first play out of the gate was to find out what the referee's made out of. I'm gonna sling that guy to the ground, go past him and sack his quarterback. If the referee flags me, I'm gonna tone it down. If the referee lets that go, wow, somebody's gonna have a bad night. And if I can manipulate that referee a little bit, come on, ref, let us play ball. This is not the prom. We're not dancing out here. We're trying to play some football. If he worried about what I think about how he refs, oh, son, welcome to the dark side of the force. It's awesome. But if that guy says, look, Jones, you do that again, I'll throw this flag. And every time you do it, I'll drop it. I'll back you to China. Every time you move, my flag will come. You get me, son? Yes, sir. And I'm a pretty good little guy to play ball with. But if you'll let me control you, I will. And the same thing about kids. If they can do something and you cave in on it, they'll do it every time. Immediacy means do you respond to it when it happens in the context. Severity means does it cost me more than it gets me. And consistency is how many times do I get this and how many times do I not. Do any of you speed? I'm not writing tickets. I don't have that power. Yes, we speed. Why do we speed? Number one, the results are not immediate, right? If he pulls you over, when do you pay that ticket? 6 months from now? Go to driving school, don't pay it at all? Is it consistent? How many times do you speed versus how many times you get caught speeding? Oh man, 1 in 100? And then how severe is it? $100? 150? I got a buddy, got married the day after he graduated college, moved to Atlanta, is an accountant. They chose, we will not have children. We will spend our lives on ourselves, his and her Corvettes. He got his racing Corvette and the Corvette he drives to work. He said, a couple hundred bucks every 6 months to go as fast as I want, anywhere I want. I don't mind that. He's a speed demon, son, I'm telling you right now. Well, suppose the next time you got pulled over, they drug you out of the car, they took a little taser and they injected a little chip into your rear end, right there. And then the next time your speedometer didn't match the sign, you got 50,000 volts right there. And every time you sped, it zapped you. Hey, you'd be riding a bicycle, wouldn't you? Enough of that. you'd have immediacy, severity, and consistency. And because we don't get immediacy, severity, and consistency, what do we do? We drive like we want to, right? That's why I eat donuts and drink chocolate milk. I don't gain weight instantly. Okay? Well, you know, I had a donut last week. I didn't gain 5 pounds. I think I'll have another one. Well, I didn't gain any weight from that. I think I'll have another one. And then all of a sudden, you know, it'll eventually catch up with you. But if, you know, if every time you ate bad, you felt bad, you'd quit eating bad. But you eat bad and you feel good. That's hard to control, isn't it? Well, your kids do the same thing. They measure, number one, versus what I'm getting and what it costs me. I'll do that. And it's really hard sometimes to understand, you know, a kid's behavior. My wife used to teach middle school science. And, you know, she hands out this worksheet, and little Johnny doesn't want to do his worksheet. A kid will do anything to get out of a worksheet. Up to, you know, blaming his neighbor. I didn't understand the instructions. He'll blame the teacher. Jackie uses three principles in classroom dealing with kids. One is calm equals control. I'm not going to jump up and down. I'm not going to raise my voice. I'm not going to pitch a fit. This is business. You know what I've asked you to do. Calm equals control. Time equals commitment. I'll lock in on you, and I'll wait till it's done. I'm not leaving this point till it happens. And then the real interesting part is proximity equals intensity. And that simply means that as you close the gap on people, things get escalated. What's your name? Celeste. That is correct. Okay. I'm going to pick on Celeste. Celeste is not doing anything wrong. She's just sitting here very stoically. So I'm writing on the board and I go, Celeste, I need you to straighten up. Now, what investment have I given Celeste? None whatsoever. She has not flinched. I stop writing on the board and I turn and make eye contact with Celeste and I'm not going to smile. Celeste, I need you to straighten up. Now, Celeste has just smiled just a little bit because she's uncomfortable. She's not doing anything wrong, but she's still uncomfortable because smiling is a sign of submission among primates. Well, I'm not going to move till you fix it. Now, she's at a disadvantage because she don't know how to fix it because she's not doing anything wrong. But she's getting uncomfortable. She's giggled again. She looked at her husband. Now, she's put her hand on his, help me. She's put her hand on his thigh. Okay? You feel like, now, watch what happens when I turn it up. Now she's covered her face. She's smiling, wants me to smile. I ain't smiling. I don't want to be your friend. I want you to do what I've asked you to do now. And if I could tell her what to do, she'd do it. And she's not doing anything wrong. In school, you put your hands on the desk or you go to your elbows. And a child will sell their soul to get you out of their space. They will crucify their neighbor. They'll do anything to make it happen. So calm equals. See, when I turn around, would you behave? That's dinner in a movie right there. I'm getting a show. You know, the teacher's jumping around having a fit. Her face turns red. But when she turns around and she looks like she's got the soul of Darth Vader, man, I don't want none of that. And you smile, that little charm. Hey, teach. Oh, crap. And then when she's... Oh, geometry class. You eat the little math guys up. And you move in close. Now, what happens is you get in that close, and that little guy's going to go, hey, you know one of your ears is bigger than the other? And if you respond to that, you're chasing a rabbit. Hey, you know your breath smells funny. Did you eat pizza today? If you respond to that, you calm equals control. I've got one thing on my mind and one thing only, and that's compliance. Well, eventually a kid in school is going to drop his choice of R-rated words. You throw the F-bomb out. What happens when a kid cusses you? You get out of my room. A kid walking down the hall to go to the principal's office, is he doing his science worksheet? Negative. You know, when I was in school, Lonnie, we're going to send you home. Thank you. I've been trying to go home all day. I didn't want to be here in the first place. You know, if you'd have just let me stay home, I wouldn't have had to get up and go through this. But now I'm gone. Yeah, see you losers later, you know. But when they cuss Jackie in her room, she pretends she didn't hear it. You understand, you don't leave this room till the worksheet's done. I'm the volleyball coach. I'll be here till 6 o'clock at night. I'll call your mom. You sit in the gym while I practice. But till it's done, we're not leaving. Your choice. He finishes that worksheet, turns it in. Bell rings, starts out. Excuse me, Celeste, you use language in my room that you're not allowed to use. I need an apology on the board to me and the students. I'm going to be late to... you should use your time better in my class. It's not really my problem, it's yours. About 2 weeks, they don't move in Ms. Jones's class. I'm scared of her too, okay? Don't get me wrong, you know. She does that stuff with me at home, you know. But it's about not throwing a fit, not losing your composure. If I can make you feel uncomfortable, or I can get you to choose to be mad, or I can get you to be demonstrative emotionally, if I can control your mood, I can control the room. Teenage girls do it by rolling their eyes. They look you in, and they look at the prefrontal cortex of their brain, and it makes a man go homicidal. Well, they won. They are in control. It's just like, you know, these aren't the droids you're looking for, because you're done. You're not going to have a good conversation with that kid after that, because they've baited you into that. And a teenage boy, whatever. Oh, makes my blood pressure. Well, as soon as I recognize you're disrupting me physiologically, you've won that engagement. When I can get you to move from the thinking part of your brain to the feeling part of your brain, you're mine. My first move off the line as a defensive end was to hit you so hard and make you look so bad and get away with that referee that you spend the rest of the night trying to even that score. Well, you're trying to even that score. You're not playing football. You're trying to even that score. And not only are you going to pay for it, your quarterback's going to pay for it. If I get on a judo mat with you and we're not friends and I don't know you and it's kind of one of those things where one of us has got to win this thing, first thing I'm going to do is push you. We'll shake hands, bump, and I'm going to give you a little push. Well, you know what 90% of the male population will do? They'll charge you, man. You charge a guy who's 5'4" and built low to the ground as wide as he is tall. You're going for a ride. Now, you may win that match. I'll throw you one time, I promise you. If you come at me fast enough, I'll get one of these little arms around you. You got 6 seconds when that arm goes around, you're going to sleep. And all it takes is you standing your ground and not coming into my trap. Well, when a teenager pushes you emotionally, psychologically, or physically, and you move out of your thinking brain to your feeling brain, you're a had lad. And discipline is about maintaining your calm and your control. Because if I can punch your buttons, I win it. And it may not be about not cleaning my room. It may be about ruining your afternoon because you made me clean my room. And so you've got to learn calm equals control, time equals commitment, and proximity equals intensity. And remember, all punishment is not discipline. All discipline is not punishment. It's putting stress in the relationship so that the result is growth. So let's take the, I don't know, cleaning of your room or picking up your toys. Now you can, okay, Johnny, I want you to pick up your toys. No, you can't make me, whatever. You can go ballistic. You can act like the hostile control guy over here. And you go, you go clean that room up or I'll take this broom and hit you every time you don't do it. But if I'm standing there over your shoulder and making you clean your room for 30 minutes, who cleans your room? If I'm going to invest my 30 minutes into it, what good did that do either one of us? Oh, I proved I'm stronger than you. I proved I'm bigger than you. And by the way, you really can't make a person who doesn't want to do something do something. I mean, you really can't, depending on how stubborn they are. My wife's dad got sick, and I was a young preacher, and she wasn't there. And a little lady walked out of the church, "Preacher, where's your wife?" I said, "Well, she's visiting her dad." "Well, if I'd have known that, I'd take you home and fed you turnip greens." I said, "Ma'am, there's not enough men in this building to feed me turnip greens." I shouldn't have said it, but that, and you know, that's true. You can't feed me turnip greens. You might get them in my mouth. You can't make them stay. It won't happen. Can't be done. Not enough of you here. Well, you think about telling some little kid, "I'm going to make you eat that broccoli." Unless you're willing to put him to sleep, liquefy it, and blow it down his throat with a straw. And by the way, if it went down there and you used a straw, he didn't eat it. You forced it down. He may go, "Well, it's in my stomach, but I didn't eat it." And he technically has a point. So you can stand there and enforce the law, and what's he learned? I can control your time as you control my time. Welcome to my world. So it's, I need you to clean your room up. Now, when I was growing up, Dad said, "Frog, we jumped." That's kind of the generation I'm in. But we never defied Dad. I hate to think what would happen if we had. But now it's, "Hey, you need to clean your room up." I don't want to. You can't make whatever. I like the philosophy of pay me now, pay me later. Hey, you need to clean your room up. Well, I will in a minute. You understand what I've asked you? All right, I go do my thing. Hey, Dad, Billy wants me to come. As soon as you clean your room. Hey, Dad, I signed up for that church. As soon as you clean your room. Hey, Dad, I got baseball practice. As soon as your room's clean. And then I'm not fussing at you. I'm not screaming at you. I'm not yelling at you. You just learn that at some point, you get to do the things you want to do on time when you've done the things I've told you to do on time. And it ain't my problem. It's yours. And that's it. Now, you've got to be willing to let them miss practice. Not go on the church retreat. Not get to go to Grandma's house at Thanksgiving. Whatever it is they want to do, nothing happens in their life till they've done what they've been told to do. And then you don't become the ogre. You don't become the screaming guy. You don't become the yelling person. You don't become the threatener. It's not personal. It's business. Life doesn't happen till that takes place. When my behavior costs me more than it costs you, I'll change my behavior. And it doesn't matter what it is. You just simply, until it's done, life doesn't take place. Second scenario is that I need you to clean your room. If it's not clean by 9:30, there's a consequence. Walk away. Yes, ma'am.
At what age can they grasp this concept? A 3-year-old?
Oh, yeah. You know, as soon, Mommy, can I have a popsicle? As soon as you clean your room. Mommy, Teletubbies is on. As soon as you clean your room. You know, you control any, and don't let your kids watch Teletubbies. That's just child abuse. Anyway, my daughter could watch Teletubbies with an empty pistol clicking at the TV. Other than that, she was not allowed to watch them. That's not true. The pistol was loaded. But you can't explain it to them, but you can teach them that experientially. And they learn pretty quick. You know, Mom asked me to do this. And especially with the little ones, you pick it up after 9:30 and it disappears. Mommy, where's my so-and-so? Where's it supposed to be? What? I asked you to pick it up. You didn't. Probably should pick it up next time I ask you. Hope it comes back. You think that Christmas elf is spooky. You know, that Mom elf is really spooky, because if you don't do what I ask you to do when I ask you to do it, there's a consequence. And it doesn't have to be a punitive consequence. It doesn't have to be I spanked you or I yelled at you or I grounded you or I stuck you in time out. It's just I didn't pick it up and something happened. I better pick it up next time. And that way you end up spending less of your time fussing and screaming, and it's just about teaching growth out of these experiences. Because you do the same thing. When I put off cutting the grass, I end up having to cut the grass and rake the grass because I let it get too tall. Well, it's better to take that extra minute and cut it when it's short, right? Clean the house a little bit every day. You don't have to clean it for a month when the company drops in. We learn the same things. We teach ourselves those lessons. Well, we teach our kids those lessons pretty early coming out of the factory. And kids have weird rewards. Kids have weird stances about, hey, you know, how does the world work and how does the world operate? But I like the idea of pay me now or pay me later. And it's simply you're taking a delaying tactic and causing that delay that they did with you to delay something else later on. That makes sense? How many of you guys are dealing with teenagers and how many of you guys are dealing with preteens? Teenagers. One, two. Everybody else got younger than teenagers? Oh, wow, this is easy. It's really not. Teenagers are easier probably. One of the things that you want to understand is that a child who is being disciplined acts like they're suffering. And they're not really suffering that bad. You understand that, right? Kids are capable of drama. How many times have you seen them hate somebody at a birthday party and 2 minutes later be giggling with them? You're the same way. This is not personal. It is business. You ever see the cartoon with the sheepdog and the coyote and they clock in? Good morning, Ralph. Good morning, Sam. I'm going to steal sheep. You're going to pound me. The whistle blows. They eat lunch together. You're the sheepdog. They're the coyote. It's not personal. It's just business. Now, if you let them run rampant and run wild, they're going to destroy a lot of stuff. But it's your job to contain the coyotes and keep them away from the sheep. And it's not because you hate them, and it's not because they hate you. They want independence. They want the path of least resistance. They want life to be comfortable. And when you interfere with it, they're going to make it your fault and blame you. And they learn that I can influence what happens to me. You chose to be unhappy because you didn't do what Dad asked. You chose to be unhappy when you knew what Mom asked. Now, I do differentiate between a kid being a kid and a kid being defiant. Okay? He leaves his teddy bear out in the yard and it rains on it and it rots. There's no need to spank a kid for that. He's got a punishment because he was a kid. Now, when you say, hey, you need to go get that teddy bear, and he goes, I ain't, you can't make me. That may be a little different response for me. I may go run over it with the lawnmower then. I don't know. Hey, look, that probably should have been picked up. I respond to defiance, real defiance, differently than I do to a child just being a child. Because some of it's about immaturity. You know, quit acting like a six-year-old. Dad, I'm six. Oh, okay. And remind yourself sometimes this is how a six-year-old acts, and it's not personal. But I think your biggest frustration as parents is it feels very personal. You feel like they hate you, or they're trying to defy you, or they're trying to mock you. And they're just being kids, and they're not really thinking about you. They're thinking about themselves. Does that make sense? So let me take a break and see if you have either general or specific questions about the discipline kind of thing.
How do you keep consequences from turning into bribery? Like, oh, if you do this, we're going to get ice cream. Versus, oh, you didn't do this, so we can't get ice cream.
I guess you set it up so that they understand that there's something there to lose rather than that you're bribing them. Fred Jones talks about responsibility training. I give you some things up front because you're on the planet and how you use that resource. It's a finite resource and you can use it. Jackie, when she taught fifth grade, gave them 30 minutes every Friday to play kickball. So, hey, because you're in Miss Jones's class, every Friday we'd go outside and we'll play kickball. Now, my wife was a walk-on to a fast-pitch softball team as a shortstop, and she enjoyed throwing a kickball to fifth graders who didn't behave, but we won't go there. Anyway, but you got 30 minutes. Now, once she gives you your 30 minutes to play kickball, she then says, these are my procedures for transitioning from math to history. This is my procedure for taking a test. This is my procedure for lining up for lunch. So then she says, okay, class, let's transition. She hits her stopwatch. They do it. Okay, very good. I expected you guys to do that in a minute. You took 2 minutes. I'm going to take one of your kickball minutes. You now have 29 minutes. Come back from lunch. Miss Jones, can I go to the bathroom? Why didn't you go to the bathroom while we were at lunch? Well, I didn't want to. Well, yeah, you can go, but I'm going to take that time off your kickball when you, hey, Miss Jones, he can hold it. All of a sudden, the kids start monitoring the other kids, and she lets them use that time. So you may start out with, hey, we've got this much allowance. We've got this much TV time. We've got this much Xbox time. We've got this much bicycle time. We've got this much whatever time. And as you use that, you lose it or gain it back. And that way, this is a resource that they're in charge of controlling. My choices influence what happens to me. Does that make sense? And that way, you know, kids expect, sometimes kids just feel like I have access to all this stuff and you can't take it away from me because I inherently, no. You, I have to feed you. And I probably have to give you clothes or I can't let you go in public. But other than that, everything else you get is a blessing. And so you can say, we get to do these things when the world works smoothly. The key to this is, don't ground a kid for 6 months. You're grounded till you're 19. Well, he doesn't have anything to live for. You've got to be smart enough to give and take away or you don't have anything to play with. Does that make sense? You know, if you put me in prison and tell me I'll never get out, I'm in prison the rest of my life, I'll kill everybody in there. I'll use the weight room when I want to. I won't have to compete with the basketball guys out in the yard. If I'm there the rest of my life, what else can you do to me? So if that's the only place I'm ever, I'm going to own it. So don't tell me I can't get out of this hole that I'm in. So when you take a kid and you say, well, you've lost all your privileges, and not only did you lose kickball, we won't play kickball till after Christmas. Well, guess what happens in that fifth grade classroom? chaos ensues. Because those delayed consequences don't mean anything to a kid. Especially kids who are preteen. They don't understand grounded for a week. They don't comprehend what a week is. You know, they think Christmas is 9 continents away and 4 light years. They have no idea. So you've got to be careful to massage those resources. And whatever it is, with some kids it's electronics. With some kids it's play outside time. Some kids it's reading time. Some kids it's an early bedtime or a late bedtime. But you've got things that you know works for them and can manipulate them. Teenagers, cell phones. Cell phones and electronics. Wow. We didn't realize that riding the bus was traumatic for our daughter. And it was like, wow, that's the best thing I ever discovered. She was somewhere she shouldn't have been with her car, so she lost the use of her car and had to ride the bus. She said, Dad, please, let me call somebody. I'll call a taxi. Dad, you run from our house to the school. It's only 5 miles. I'll walk to school. Don't make me ride the bus. That was the greatest discovery I ever had in my life. You're now a victim of the cheese wagon. And then, you know, it was just, you know, for a sophomore, junior in high school, it was worse than death eating a biscuit to ride the school bus. But we found out that it wasn't that she couldn't use her car, it was she had to ride the bus. And that was, wow, that was the greatest discovery in the world. And then the cell phone, too, with those teenagers. Teenagers, cell phone, electronics, and money works for them. With the little guys, it may be TV time, iPad time, friend time. But you've got something that they don't want to give up because they do this. And you just got to know your child well enough to make it work. Other questions? Did I answer that okay? Let's look at Hebrews 12. It's a really cool verse. In Hebrews 12, what the writer is doing there is he's talking to people about not giving up. He's talked about the people who lived because of their faith. And interestingly enough, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow in Frankfort, Kentucky, you have people here who, because of their faith, stopped the sword, quenched fire, and had the dead raised to life. And you have people, because of their faith, who were burned alive, cut in half, and wandered around in the wilderness in goatskins. Their faith did not affect their circumstances. But their circumstances did not affect their faith. And when you think about suffering, I think we get the idea that somehow as Christians we're immune to suffering. So the Hebrew writer begins to talk about, if you understand suffering, you should view suffering the same way you view discipline. And this discussion is not necessarily about parenting or discipline, but it's the function that God lets suffering have in our lives. And he says that suffering has a disciplinary or a training function. And listen to these comparisons that he makes about this. The King James Version uses the word chastening. I'm going to substitute the word discipline for chastening. Hebrews 12, verse 5. Have you forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons? My son, do not despise the discipline of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he disciplines and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure discipline, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there that a father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which we've all become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. So first thing, what's the assumption he makes about discipline? Why do fathers discipline their children? You love them. Go back to that chart. If I'm love and permissiveness and there's never any discipline, then I don't really love you. In fact, what he says here is a father who doesn't take the time to discipline his son is treating that son like an illegitimate child. Read the old King James Version. It'll shock you, the word they use there. Read that on Sunday morning sometimes, okay? Because he says, if you've got a father who doesn't spend the time with you to discipline, he's treating you like the product of a fornicated relationship. He treats you like an illegitimate son. So understand that when you discipline someone, the function of discipline is, the motivation behind it is because I love you. Now, what he's saying about suffering is God allows us to deal with our own consequences because he loves us. Everything God's ever asked us to do is good for us. Everything God's ever asked us not to do is bad for us. And if I break God's law and it doesn't cost me anything, then God doesn't love me. God was telling me a lie. But when I do it in a way that God doesn't want me to do it, and it cost me something, I recognize that God loves me enough to let me suffer my own consequences, so I learn from it. That's what he talks about with God chastening us or God disciplining us. He lets us see that he means business. When I tell a child, don't touch the hot oven, and I pull him away and push him away, at some point, you know what the best lesson he's going to learn? Hey, that thing's hot, and he won't touch it again. But I'm not going to dive over the counter and body tackle him to keep him from blistering his finger. That's a lesson you learn experientially, and you won't repeat it. Well, sometimes God says, don't do this. And he's not going to blue bolt us out of this. When you do it, you see what happens. Well, I learned that God loves me enough to let me suffer my own consequences. Everybody okay with that? Second thing he says. Furthermore, verse 9, we have had human fathers who corrected us. You do things you're not supposed to do, and what did your human father do? He put stress in a relationship. He corrected you, and we paid them respect. What's a byproduct of discipline? Now, if you've got to choose between your kids liking you or your kids respecting you, which one are you going to choose? Do you remember your best friend from high school? Do you remember 5 friends from high school? Some of you may have gone to a small high school and you guys were extremely close. But most of us outgrow our high school friends, right? My daughter, when she was in high school, had friends. She didn't need me. She outgrew those high school friends. She still respects me. Some of that to her credit, some of it to my credit, okay? But what you're doing is you're trying to get the respect of your kids, not their friendship or their admiration. They've got to know that when you have a rule and you have a principle in your home, you mean business when they do it. If they can break your rule and nothing happens, they know you're made out of paper. They know nothing happens. And if you don't earn that respect by, you know what Dad said, if I did that, you know how many people don't follow up with discipline? You're grounded. If you ground a kid, he better stay grounded till the grounding is over. You're grounded till Friday, but you can go on the church trip. We're going on the church trip, but your mom and I are going with you. No. Yeah, well, you signed up to go, so you can't lie to Chris Webb. You can't lie to Chris, so you got to go. But since we can't trust you, we're going with you. I hope we sit on the bus together. Now you can choose. But if you go, we're going with you because you violated trust. But if you go, well, it's a church thing, so you get to go. Then what did it cost him to break your rule? What did it cost him to violate your principles? He can still go, but you go with him because he's violated his trust or her trust or whatever. But if you tell them they can't, you're grounded, but you can go to practice. You can't drive your car, but you can still go to work. At some point, you're sending a mixed message. You're either grounded or you're not. And I think that it needs to be one of those things. So make sure that you're able to consistently do what you say you're going to do, or your kids find out that you're not real and they won't respect you. So the byproduct of that is respect. And again, I know these stories because I lived them. But our daughter, when she was tiny, 3 or 4 maybe, I don't know. We trained on Tuesdays. And we used to train from 6 to 2 with SWAT. And so that was just kind of a night that I'm gone, and Jackie would do things with the ladies at church or play volleyball or whatever. But they always went to bed early. My wife has an energy czar that, she turns into a pumpkin pretty fast during school. And I came in one Tuesday night, and she's up. She's on the couch awake. Well, the only 2 times I've ever come in, she's been awake. She broke something, either her leg or her foot playing volleyball. So I walk in the door, and she's awake. I go, oh, no, are you all right? And she goes, no, it's not me, it's the baby. What's wrong with the baby? Well, Went to this ladies' thing at church. And at ladies' things, they eat, apparently. And so they're there, and Lonnie Beth is going through the line with her mom and just on those little tiptoes, and she's getting all kind of food. And Jackie's putting the food back. Lonnie Beth's getting food. Jackie's putting it back. Well, she gets over here by herself and gets this piece of cake that's big enough to choke Conan the Barbarian. And I mean, she's, you know, and Jackie says, if you get that, you'll eat it. The line has been drawn in the sand. Jackie sits down. Lonnie Beth sits down at the munchkin table, takes one bite of this cake, toddles over to the trash can, gets up on the tippy toes, and drops it in. Jackie said she got up, got it out, set it on the plate. Said, I got a key. We'll be here till it's gone. Steady stream of little girls. Miss Jones, there's invisible things called germs. I'm a science teacher. Get out of my face. So we sat there till she ate the cake. She said, I don't know if I did the right thing or not. I said, well, she called your bluff, and, you know, as silly as it was to say, I'm going to be here to, you backed up what you said. At about 3:30, I hear the noise from there in the house. I put my sweatpants on, walk in. I sit down in the hallway. There she is, looking under the hood of the porcelain Porsche, up there on those little tippy toes. Baby, what's wrong? I'm sick. Why are you sick? Mama made me eat garbage cake. I said, why did Mama make you eat garbage cake? I did not obey. I thought she would spank me. Yeah. At 3 or 3 and a half. She says, you know what? I'll take a couple of licks, but I ain't eating your cake. Strap that on. And Jackie said, I think we'll eat the cake. Probably a serendipitous occasion where she actually... But we learned pretty quick, you know, this girl's going to be stubborn like her mother. Man, God, you know, dodge that bullet. But she said, this is what I said. This is what will happen. And you did it. And her calculation was, I'll take a spanking, but you're not going to do what you said to do. Well, she said what she was going to do. And not in a, you know, she didn't stand there and stuff cake down her. She just, we'll be here till it's gone. And so you'll earn the respect of your children with immediacy, severity, and consistency. If you don't do the consistency part, you're not going to gain the respect part. Next verse. Furthermore, we had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father's spirits and live? Now, they indeed for a few days disciplined us as seemed best to them. But He, for our profit, that we may be partakers in His holiness. Two things happen in that verse. One is that our human fathers disciplined us according to their best judgment. And you do get some judgment. You do get some discernment here. Second thing is that God disciplines us, and it's for our profit. Please, please, please understand that your discipline interaction with your children is to improve them as people, to put stress in a relationship so the result is growth. Do not parent your children based on your perceptions of the expectations of the church. They're your children. To my minister friends in the room, parent your children based on what God expects from them, not what the brethren expect from them. Because I see a lot of folks get in trouble with, oh, the church people think that. What does God think? And what are your family values? And nobody else gets to vote. Okay? And there are some decisions that fall under the Romans 14. I'm convinced about it. You're convinced about it. But you don't get to vote at my house. Okay? When my children stand in judgment, they're not going to ask you about it. They're going to ask me about it. And so please, when you discipline your children, make decisions that are for their profit or for their growth, not making decisions about your kids' behavior so I'll feel better about it. Because when you start letting other people dictate how you control your kids, then you've told your kids that public opinion matters, and then you'll 10 years from now say, oh, by the way, don't worry about peer pressure. you've got to discipline them according to your values. And the things you let your kids do versus the things you don't let your kids do have got to be the things that you and your spouse agree on. They line up with God, do they line up with our values? And I don't really need a lot of input from some outside source. And I don't mean that in a condescending or an arrogant way. You know, we made some decisions with our daughter that were based on us as people, and some of the churches that we were involved with were not very happy about that. And if that's a deal breaker, that's a deal breaker. But I wasn't going to let the church control, you know, what our children were allowed to do because of my expectations as a minister. My daughter raised according to our values and God's values, not what you were comfortable with a minister's daughter being allowed to do. And I think you need to do the same thing. If you've got a small child and it's making noise in the assembly, you know what small children do? They make noise in the assembly. We sit there and shake them. Sit still. And God says, wiggle. Because they're supposed to move those little arms and legs. And anybody who's ever had a small one understands. And anybody who doesn't understand ain't ever had a small one. Deal with it. They can move if your kid's too disturbing. Okay? And quit worrying about what other people think about your child. If your child is in church, it's where you and the child need to be. And quit worrying about that little old lady who turns around and looks at her. Okay? You can pick a child up on your shoulder and pull that diaper down real fast and moon them. It's a really slick move. And just, I'm just saying, but you're there with your kid in church because they need to be there. And a little bit of noise and a little bit of drama and them being little kids is part of what they're supposed to be about. Okay? And folks who are going to put that pressure on you, they've either forgotten what it was to have small children or are not living in reality. And you know, their behaviors where your child needs to be taken out of the auditorium. But a lot of times I see people get so self-conscious about that that it ruins their worship experience. And it's not that your child's acting that bad. You're worried about the other people's reactions. They disciplined us as seemed best to them. And God disciplines us so we can be partakers in His holiness. So your discipline issues with your children have to be about what benefits them, profits them, and causes them to grow, not about how I perceive what you're doing with your child, because it's your child. Everybody okay with that? Next verse. Verse 11. Now no discipline seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. That's one of those duh verses in the Bible. You know, I don't know how it works when you take something out of one language and put it in another language. But in this situation, you think, you know, I think that was pretty obvious. That's like in the story in Judges, and it says, and she drove a tent stake through his temple, and so he died. I figured that part out. I knew what was coming after the tent stake went through his temple. So it's one of those duh verses. No discipline is joyful for the present, but painful. Old King James Version says grievous. Discipline's hard work. Discipline takes time. Discipline takes energy. Discipline is uncomfortable. It's easier to let your kids run buck wild. It's easier not to make an issue out of cleaning the room. It's easier not to fool with homework. It's just easier to go, you know what, I don't care what you do. And doing it makes you go to bed sometimes crying. You feel like, man, you know, all I did was be on those kids all day. It's hard work. Well, you done everything, anything that required discipline? You ever gotten in shape for a run? You ever put together a serious project? What does it take to be disciplined when it comes to keeping your house or keeping your yard or maintaining your car? Everything that's worth doing is hard. It seems to be painful at the present, but afterward, what's the aftermath of this? You do the discipline, you pay your dues up front. Afterward, it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness by those who have been trained by it. The operative word here is that once this process is over, you get peace and righteousness as a result. And not only do you get peace and righteousness, but it results in training And that's really the word for discipline. The word for discipline is training. And you know, if you've ever trained a dog, it's not about punishment. It's about teaching the animal to respond appropriately in certain circumstances. The verse in Proverbs is, train up a child in the way he'll go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Well, you know, what does it mean to have a well-trained child? A child who has responsibility, accountability, consistency, honesty, good manners, and you model that, and you teach that, and you enforce that, and at the end of that, you end up with a fruit of peace and a fruit of righteousness. Any questions? Yes, ma'am. Number one, consider the source. We spend a lot of time worrying about what people we don't value or respect say anyway. When I talk to kids about peer pressure, I say, those kids picking on you in school, do you respect them? No. Then why do you worry about what they think? You know, that's like me jogging and some guy pull up beside me, you know, drinking a beer, smoking a cigarette, going, hey, you're an idiot. And I care about your opinion on fitness. Why? You know, and so first, number one is the source you're getting the garbage from, somebody that you value. Now, if you value their opinion, you go, do they have a point here? So, you know, when I receive negativity, and I teach this in a bullying class, by the way, not how to bully, but how to deal with bullying. I teach one of those too, by the way. I can't make a bully not bully. I can make a bully not bully you. That's a different class, but. When somebody bullies you, somebody says something back, you know, there's a flow chart. And what I do is I draw a dog. His name is Fido. Fido stands for forget it, drive on. Okay? And so somebody says something to you. Question number one, is it true? And there's a yes or no. Lonnie, you have purple ears. Well, I shaved my head this morning and in the mirror my ears weren't purple. So is it true? No. Forget it, drive on. Lonnie, you're short and bald. Is that true? Well, yes. Second question, can I change it? No. Forget it. Drive on. Okay, Lonnie, not only are you short and bald, but you're a little fluffy around the edges. Is that true? Yeah. Can I change it? Yeah. Does it need to be changed? One of my hobbies is I hang out with a SWAT team. One of the things we regularly do is we fight. We do ground fighting. They teach a thing called SSGT. It's based in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I goof around with a kid in Decatur who's the highest ranked Eddie Bravo student on the East Coast. He's a brown belt under Eddie Bravo. They teach no-gi submissions. They like to roll around with me because I don't have a neck. So I go there and roll with those guys. If I weighed the 145 pounds my doctor says I need to weigh, it'd be like those guys playing with a beach ball. I like to weigh north of 170, so I'm somebody on a judo mat. So yeah, I can change it, but for me, it doesn't need to be changed. My resting heart rate's around 55. I can still run a pretty consistent pace. I'm not a racer, but I run a pretty consistent pace. I did the Murph for Memorial Day. I just did a seal fit thing with the guys. I'm okay for a 52-year-old, so no, it doesn't need to be changed. Forget it, drive on. Lonnie, sometimes you're so busy, you're disorganized. Is that true? Yes. Can I change that? Yeah. Does it need to be changed? Yeah, probably. You just told me something that made me a better man. I can get mad about that if I want to. but addressing that is for my profit. So when they say something about your child or your parenting style, number one, what's the source? Do you respect it or not? If you don't respect it, I give it to Fido pretty quick. But even if I don't respect it, is it true? Can I change it? Does it need to be changed? And you and your husband get to decide those three questions. That make sense? Now, the other part is, well, I'll tell you what, you can hold him next Sunday and I'll sit and judge you. I really like that. I mean, that always works for me. Lonnie Beth went through a phase where she headbutted. It was the coolest thing. I mean, pre-walking age. And, of course, Jackie put her in all these frills and fluffles and things. And you'd be holding her hands and she'd be balanced on your knees. And wham! She'd hit you like a cobra. I mean, right there. Your eyes would water. It's like, oh, boy, you know. And you just sit there and you see the hand of Jesus reaching for you, you know, like an ice cream headache. But right there, you'd take her outside and you'd be out there in the foyer, you know, trying to not pass out in one of them little legs. Let me hold that baby. Ma'am, you don't want to hold this baby. Give me that baby. You don't want to hold it. So, bam! You know, they hand her back, you know. It was great. I loved it. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, oh, you think you're good? Hold this baby. You get headbutted. It's great stuff. So consider the source. If it is beneficial, adjust. If it's not beneficial, don't waste a lot of time on it. Words that other people tell you only have the power you give them. Please remember that. It's a two-edged sword. You're responsible as a word user to use good words. Let your speech be with grace seasoned with salt. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but only what is good, that it may impart necessary edification for the hearer. Ephesians 5, 4, 25, 26, 27. Okay? That's my responsibility as a word user. But when words come to me, those words only have as much power as I give them. Romans 1, 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. God's salvation word, God's powerful word, only has any effect in my life if I believe it. I know a lot of people who read this book and go, it's a fairy tale, and it has no effect in their lives. Why? They didn't give it any power. Well, if God's power is limited by whether I accept it, your words have seriously got a governor on them. So other people's words only have as much power as you give them. A lie only has as much power as you give it. And sometimes we allow certain people to have power in our lives that they just shouldn't have. Look at the story of Elijah. He's standing on Mount Carmel and God answers his prayer. He burns an altar to the ground and licks up the water. And then Jezebel says, I'm going to kill you tomorrow. And he panics. How in the world does he give Jezebel that kind of power in his life? If I've just had God light a fire and you send me a nasty gram that says, I've asked the gods to kill you tomorrow, say, hey, meet me on Mount Carmel. You stand over there, I'll stand over here. You ask your gods to kill me and I'll ask my God to kill you. We'll see how that works out for you. You know? But instead, he takes her words. He runs off in the wilderness and says, God, I'm done. Let me die. So whoever this is, you've got to decide, credible source, am I going to respect their opinion? And then once I decide yes or no, is it true? Can I change it? Does it need to be changed? And you come to the proper conclusion on those answers, just kind of let it roll off your back. And your child won't be 14 months forever. Okay? Anybody else? That's right.
And so I think that might also be what you're experiencing. Like people just kind of assume you know nothing with your first. But our second is a whole new ballgame from our first. So I kind of feel like we knew more with our first then.
Yeah, my brother reminds me, he says, you realize they stopped after you. I'm the youngest in the family. He goes, you realize there's none after you. What is that supposed to mean? Of course, he was compliant and a good kid. And, you know, I mean, I'm that guy. But and so, yeah, I think a lot of times that you get treated like a rookie parent by people who've had kids and they think you know nothing, and then you get a two or three and they think, well, kids are different. The rules change radically between firstborn and secondborn, middle child, boy versus girl. You know, if you have your girl first and then your boy, eh. If you have a boy first and then a girl, oh my. Because you think, what in the world? You know, we had a puppy and a Tasmanian devil. I mean, it's just really, because they learn drama before they can walk, man. It's unbelievable. I've seen little bitty ones just pout. Those little girls, they have those little moods. And you're like, what in the world, you know? It's great. I just randomly hand them money. It's awesome. But but yeah, I think that you've got to consider the source and realize that you're neither a complete novice nor a complete expert ever when it comes to kids. And you're never an expert when it comes to other people's kids, because you don't know the dynamic of that child. And some kids are just wired different. Look at the difference in a Yorkie and a Jack Russell Terrier. Some of you were blessed to have Yorkies. Some of you have Jack Russells. Some of you have Mexican border rats. But, you know, they look like dogs, but they're really not. And you just have to kind of learn to, you know. And the cool thing is, your child's personality is distinct and unique. And don't change it. It will guide them into who they're supposed to be for God. It will guide them in, and quit worrying about what your child is not, and celebrate what your child is. And that's if they've got a learning disability or a physical disability, or whether they've got a attention problem or a non-attention problem. You know, some of those things, in order for me to talk about a disorder, there must be a dysfunction. And if there's not a dysfunction, I'm not going to treat a disorder. Oh, my kid's got ADD. He's making C's in school. And is he getting discipline reports every day to where they're going to kick him out of school? No. And he's passing all his classes. Yeah, he's a boy. That's the teacher's problem to deal with. You don't have to make him up to her expectations. My brother's valedictorian, top 1% of the nation, top 10% of anybody who ever took the law school entrance exam. I was a solid BC student, well, actually solid C student. I dated a girl at Harding. She said, I've never made a B. I said, me neither. and we meant different stuff by it, by the way. But my parents never expected me to be academic like Gerald. And they never expected Gerald to be like me. And I think we both turned out fairly successful. Our daughter has a learning disability. She exempted the graduation exam in math in the state of Alabama. I mean, severe mathematical learning disabilities. Couldn't balance a checkbook if her immortal soul depended on it. She played volleyball on a Division I scholarship. She's 4'10". The shortest person to ever step on a Division I court. Amazingly gifted athletically. Unbelievable stuff she can do in that little compact little body. They paid her $1,000 per inch of her height. If she'd have been 6 foot, it would have been a moneymaker. But she's 58 inches, so she paid her $58,000 to play volleyball. She can draw, she can paint, she can sculpt. She runs her own photography business. She can write with a plasma cutter, better than I can write with a pencil. One of her roommates in school was on an academic and a volleyball scholarship, and their power went out. She took the socket off the wall and wired the room. I said, where'd you learn to do that? She said, Dad, how hard can it be? There's a couple of wires, and one of them was black, and I changed it. I said, so would you rather be smart like her or smart like you? She said, I think I'd be smart like me every time. And we just quit worrying about grades. As long as you're eligible to play volleyball, that's all you got to worry about. Now, she's a pretty cool little person. But if we beat her about you got to make A's and B's, she'd hate us and hate herself. And she's a pretty interesting little person. Now, when she was in school, I mean, it was wow. We came up with the idea, hey, you know what? I quit worrying about monitoring your grades. You make an A average, your curfew's 11 o'clock. You make a B average, your curfew's 10 o'clock. you make a C average, your curfew's 9 o'clock. You make less than a C, you don't have a curfew because you ain't going nowhere. And so I quit. It's not, they're not my grades, they're yours. You need help, ask me. Because she's like me, has trouble asking for help. So she felt like if she asked for help, she was stupid. So for a long time, she just wouldn't. Well, when grades and curfew became the same, she wanted to stay out later. So you'd be surprised at the hard work she put in to keep her grades up. Now, the first time we enacted that, she comes home from school and she signed up for conditioning, PE, and welding. Well, we had to modify that a little bit. You do have to take an academic class once in a while. But, you know, like I say, she can write with a plasma cutter better than I can write with a pencil because she can weld. Now, it took me like 2 states to buy pink Carhartts so she could weld in them, but she had them and, you know, she can weld. But she's an amazing little person. And we just quit worrying about, you know, everybody, oh, my daughter made an A. Well, my daughter didn't. But she's a pretty valuable little person. And so learning to celebrate who your children are rather than fussing and fighting and regretting who they're not. And we all have to do that about ourselves. You know, you all have limitations. And you can spend your whole life wishing to be taller, shorter, thinner, fatter, stronger, weaker, faster, slower. Or you can go, this is who I am. And learning to be comfortable with who you are and learning to be comfortable with who you're not is one of the keys to maturity. Learning that God made me and I'm infinitely priceless. I think it's a very healthy way to view yourself, a very healthy way to view your children. Attention deficit disorder kids function well in chaos. The fire alarm goes off and smoke starts blowing and light starts flashing and things start falling out of the ceiling. People who are very linear and very academic tend to freeze up. An ADD kid can focus on, I need to drag that guy out of here. And he goes, gets him and gets him out. They make excellent first responders. They make pretty good special operators. Pretty interesting people. But when we try to stick them in this box that this is success, then we ruin who they are. Now they got to learn to cope with who they are, and they got to learn that, hey, your first thought sometimes is a wrong thought. You know, the basal ganglia and the dopamine receptors and prefrontal cortex are not wired properly, and so when they concentrate, their brain cools off and it's not stimulated enough. And so their body tries to self-regulate. They feel better when they're on adrenaline. So when a kid jumps up on a seat and wants to sword fight with you, with his pencil, his brain is trying to self-regulate. It's an amazing thing God created there. You got to teach him. Well, you know, it's probably not the best thing to sword fight in class. So you got to go down on your chart. I teach that my ADD kids and my bipolar kids, your first thought is a wrong thought. Pick the next option down. Hey, you send a kid to the desert and you turn him into a special operator. He's intelligent, he thinks out of the box, he's highly motivated, and you teach him that a proper solution to a problem is to kill someone. Well, once he has that skill set, it stays in his skill set. So he's standing in line at the theater and somebody breaks line. Guess what pops up on his screen of options? I could garrote him. I could knife him through the ribs. Well, go down a few lines, ask him to move or don't make it a big deal. But he has that thought process. Well, what you use in the desert, you can't use it in the theater. And we teach our post-traumatic stress guys, that's a skill set for a certain situation. It's not a skill set for every situation. An ADD kid has to learn, hey, I've got this skill set that I'm pre-wired for. Can't use it in the fifth grade. Can't use it at the concert. Can't use it in church. First thought, wrong thought, let's move down. And then instead of trying to change them, you didn't cause it. You can't cure it. How do you cope with it? How do you make it work for you? How do you be successful with it? And that's the way I deal with disabilities. That's the way I deal with learning differences. That's the way I deal with terminal illness. That's the way I deal with a lot of things. It comes from a grief model that when life doesn't turn out like I expect it to, I suffer loss. And humans grieve all losses. And so quit comparing your kids to their kids. They're your kids. Celebrate who they are. Celebrate who they aren't. And in order for me to treat a disorder, in order for me to label it and say, this is broke, you've got to give me a demonstrable dysfunction. You've got to show me where they're not thriving. And you show me that, and then we'll talk about ADD or OCD or whatever. But in some cases, there's not a dysfunction, so we won't talk about a disorder. That makes sense. It's a little simplistic, I realize, and some of the psychological world doesn't agree with that, but it works okay for me. Any questions? All right, let me wrap up this PowerPoint. I need to change PowerPoints, so when we finish this, we'll take a little break while we change. I want to share a little bit more information with you. Basically, we've done encourage, comfort, and urge. And the ultimate goal for us as Christian parents is that you walk worthy of God who calls you into His own kingdom and glory, that you live good lives for God who calls you into His glorious kingdom, to live in a way that would honor God. 3 John 3 says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. If you've got a football player, that's great. If you've got an academic All-American, that's great. If you've got a concert pianist, that's great. But when we start saying, this is God's football player, this is God's academic All-American, this is God's concert pianist, once we teach them to live lives that honor God and they're God's children first, then what we do with them as children becomes a significantly different activity, focus, or achievement. All right? Let's take a quick break. This is our big break, right?
We'll wrap up at quarter to five.
Okay, so we'll take a pretty good break. We're going to change out my PowerPoint and got just a little bit of information I want to share with that, and then we'll continue.